Embark on a journey with us where resilience meets opportunity. This is the Dirt Road to Success.
Hi, I'm Skip Kalvin. Welcome back to Dirt Road to Success. Dr. Chit is back with us again on this show. We just finished up a show talking about the community banks, regional banks, and the big banks that are too big to fail. We also promoted Swigsby, one of the greatest banking schools in the nation. Highly recommend you look into that if you're a banker and you want to learn how to really run a bank. But this next show, we're going to talk about the community banks some more because that's my passion. And then secondly, I want to talk about some consolidation coming. So, Dr. Chit, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yep. So we talked a little bit last show about the community banks and how they really are grassroots and they really play a major role in the communities. But, you know, we talked about a couple things that need to be important in these small communities. One is a bank and one is a hospital. Okay. And there's communities, 250 plus counties across the state of Texas. But let's take it a little bit further out. Let's go nationwide. And you've got community banks, I think you mentioned about 4,000 across the nation. Each of those banks in some capacity play a major role in their communities. What do you see as one of the greatest things that community banks can do today under this environment, this climate, to prepare and to be stronger going forward that they can maintain being in a community bank?
I think probably the most important thing is to let not only their customers, but also their regulators, their elected officials know that they're not doing the same things that those super big banks are doing. Mm-hmm. They're not doing crazy, risky international financial transactions. They're not doing all kinds of derivatives that could have huge payoffs, but could cost the bank millions of dollars.
Sure.
They're doing bread and butter banking.
Bread and butter.
You know, and it really is at the community banking level, it's banking 101. You know, we collect those local deposits, we make loans to the local businesses. If we have a little bit of extra, then we put it in some pretty safe investments. Every once in a while, maybe we need to go to the Fed or out into the financial markets and borrow a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. But it's basic banking.
Basic banking.
And the regulations that are aimed oftentimes at the offenders are those top 100 banks. Mm-hmm. And it's not the community banks that are doing a lot of this crazy stuff, if you will.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the most important thing is for them to be able to point to, look what we're doing for the local communities. We're not doing anything to harm the financial system. Just kind of let us continue to do what we've been doing, which is help the economic growth of our local communities.
You know, you mentioned something that just brought back a flood of memories for me. So when I started at Wells Fargo, whatever, 20 years ago, whenever it was, Jeff Greenway was our regional president. Jeff Greenway went on and started Green Bank. And then I think they made some acquisitions and then ended up selling out. But you mentioned bread and butter. And I'm going to tell you, this first year of banking for me was like a disaster. I didn't have any idea what I was doing. And I was just out there chasing everything I could possibly chase. And I remember Jeff Greenway sitting down with me and he said, Skip, he said, we need you to focus on bread and butter, bread and butter. So he really, that terminology, bread and butter, stayed is in my brain until this day. I think about it. We focus on bread and butter right down the middle of the fairway. Don't get out of the box. Don't do crazy stuff. Just stay right on the bread and butter. And I remember when Jeff Greenway came and he was the case study. Remember his bank was the case study.
Yep.
And I'm walking across. I'm there at SMU and I'm walking across. I think I'm in my junior year or senior year of Swigsby. And he's walking across and I said, bread and butter. And he looked at me and he grinned real big. And of course, we had a good time catching up. And you know, it's people like that, Jeff Greenway, the Mark Masseys, the Paul Gianellis, the Becky Arsenos, and all those that shaped the way I looked at banking. And then I get on into later into my career, and you got a John Ulmer, who was my boss at one bank, and Dennis Washington. And, you know, it was those one-on-one conversations, because even you might be in banking 20 years, you can still learn something. And I would love to say that I've seen every type of deal, but that's not possible because every deal is different. And so when you think about community banking and you talk about what you said earlier about really engaging your local politicians, whether it be a state rep, or it be your local congressman or your state senator, your mayor, all the people that are influential within that community, and letting them understand you play a significant role as a community bank in this market. Because when the chips are down, the big banks are going to be focused on the big banks. They're going to be focused on their shareholders. But these community banks are going to be focused on that community.
Exactly.
And that's what I love about the community banking. I think it's that grassroots. It's that mom and pop diner that come in and say, hey, our ice machine went out and we need $5,000 to replace it. I mean, I know it sounds simple, but that's and it's the farmer that comes in and says, hey, I want to buy the farm next to me and I need $1.5 million for this farm, and we do an ag loan for it. I mean, it's really knowing who you're doing business with as a relationship. And, you know, that's one of the things the bank I work for is it's the people you know. And that's the great thing about the community is you get plugged in politically, you get plugged in spiritually through the church, you get plugged in financially through the bank, you get plugged in through the grocery store. Everybody knows everybody as you're walking around. So, well, let's shift gears a little bit to consolidation, because I think we're going to see some consolidation this year, next year. I think you're going to see some collaborative effort, which we talked about earlier, collaborative effort between some small community banks to join forces to be able to pick up some of the products and services that's going to keep them competitive in the communities. What are your thoughts?
Well, if history is any guide, you go back to 1980, and these are going to be broadly rounded numbers. We had ballpark 14,000, a little over 14,000 banks in the country.
Okay.
And then you get to 2000, so 20 years later, and we're at about 8,600 banks.
Okay.
And then you go 20 years later, and we're a little over 4,000 banks. So not exactly, but ballpark, we're falling by half every 20 years.
About every 20 years, yeah.
So if that continues, we'll be down to about 2,000 banks going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so what drives that? Well, part of it is just the underlying business concept of economies of scale, right? If we have fixed costs, and so one of those fixed costs in banking that's becoming a greater and greater fixed cost is compliance.
Absolutely.
As we have more and more regulations, the cost of compliance gets bigger and bigger. And as your bank grows, well, then we can spread that cost out over more customers, more accounts, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I can merge with the other community bank next door, we only need one compliance officer for our two banks together. If we're separate, we need a compliance officer each.
Right.
So we can, by growing, by consolidating, we can help spread out those costs and reduce them overall for, you know, each customer and each and for our bank overall. I think that's a big driver of it. Part of it also is concerns if you are in some counties that are supported mostly by one large employer. You're not very well diversified in the event that something happens to that employer.
Right.
If they get bought out, for whatever reason, the local plant closes down, that's a lot of jobs for some of these counties. Mm-hmm. And if all the bank makes or loans to the employees of that particular company, that's not going to be good for the bank.
Right.
And so by spreading out over a couple of counties, maybe, then we can diversify that a little bit. We've got more than one big employer for all of our customers. And so those are some of the things that are driving this consolidation. I think with technology, the need to be bigger just to offer the same products that the big banks offer is declining. So, for example, having a banking app 15 years ago was a huge deal.
Yeah.
Today, virtually every bank has it. Mm-hmm. Why? Because that's something that's been turned into a commodity, and you don't have to develop your own banking app. You can go purchase basically
right.
The shell of one. It was the same thing with banking online.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, the smaller banks just couldn't do it. Well, then you had fintech companies that came out and said, look, we've got the shell for you. All you've got to do is plug in your info and you're ready to go. Now, back when this first started, if you went to five different banks, it was funny that their online banking programs looked identical except for the logos.
Right.
It's because they were.
Yeah.
And over time, they've been able to customize them, make them a little bit different. So I think technology has allowed a lot of banks to not have to grow as much as they thought maybe they needed to compete with the big banks. If I can take a picture of my check and deposit it, and my bank is a $200 million bank or a $20 billion bank, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter anymore. That's right.
There's ATM machines everywhere, so I can have access if I actually need cash.
And let's talk about ATMs. You talk about ATM. Let's talk about ITM. So I will tell you, I fought the ITM in the beginning, and now I absolutely love it. So the ITM is where you actually have the screen. You're actually talking to a teller. Doesn't matter where you are. You walk up, you can handle any transaction on the ITM, where the ATM is still limited on what you can and cannot do.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm a huge proponent. So I'm coming out of the dinosaur age, kicking and screaming for the most part, but I'm really liking the ITM. You mentioned that the products and services, you might not have to do consolidation. See, I look at it a little bit differently. I think you're going to see some really heavily strong loan-to-deposit banks that are maxed out, are going to be looking for some of these smaller banks in these communities that are heavily deposit-to-loan relationship. And they're saying, look, we've got some capacity here. But I think I know for our bank, we probably have, and I'm not just saying it because I work there, I am super impressed with our product line and mix. It is something that you think a $50 billion bank would have. And we're not. We're a $3 billion bank, a little under $3 billion bank. But we have the products and services that we could do anything. And I'm super impressed with that. So you're right. You don't have to be a $50 billion bank to have all these services. I mean, we have everything you can imagine, even international, for a under $3 billion bank. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
FX, investment banking tools, we've got it all. So, but when you think about these small community banks out there, let's say in the middle of Nevada and wherever, these small community, if they join forces, does it give them an opportunity to be stronger financially in the long run?
Well, absolutely. To your point, if you have one bank that's real heavy on the loan side and they mm-hmm. really could use some more deposits, and you've got another bank that's real heavy on the deposit side and they could really use some more loans, mm-hmm. by matching those up, I mean, by putting them together, you're really complementing mm-hmm. the whole. And it is one of those where, in that case, the sum is much greater than the two individual entities. And again, as I mentioned before, it gives them an opportunity to diversify a little bit in terms of their customer base, the employee base that might be there, and the types of customers that they're going to have. Again, if you've got different types of employers, so if you're talking, you mentioned Nevada, a large part of that's going to be tourism, but not everything's tourism in Nevada.
Right.
And so you're going to have some agriculture in the area. Mm-hmm. So if you've got one bank that tends to cater more towards the folks maybe a little bit closer to Reno or a little bit closer to Las Vegas, and you've got others that are catering to the more remote counties, and you put them together, mm-hmm. yeah, they're going to complement each other pretty well. And again, the ups and downs, the whole idea of diversification, right, is the ups and downs in one area is going to be offset by the ups and downs in the other area.
And you mentioned earlier, one of the things, that accretiveness that you get off of consolidation, where you have duplicate officers doing the same thing, you can consolidate that down to one. I also see something in the industry, and I don't know if you do. I mean, this is just me talking, right? But there's a huge delta between leadership in the bank today, age-wise, and the next generation of leaders coming up. And, I feel like I'm kind of coming in the last maybe 10 years of my career, and I'm looking at, okay, what am I going to do the next 10 years? What does that look like? But you have a lot of people that are in their 60s as running banks, but there's a gap between the next generation of leaders. What do we do about that? Because, we don't need to lose that knowledge. I mean, these guys have got 40 plus years experience, and there's so much that we need them to pass on to that next generation. How do we separate that gap through these mergers?
Well,
or I'm sorry, close that gap. Sorry.
I would go back to say it's in a sense even more fundamental, where the mergers may or may not impact that, but it truly is succession planning. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the great things, as we mentioned, about community banks is a lot of them are family owned. They're heavily invested in the community, and they want to do what's best for the community. But they also don't want to, if they're family run, you've got maybe the matriarch or the patriarch that's running the bank.
Yeah.
They don't want to think about not running the bank anymore. Mm-hmm. For a lot of them, their whole identity is wrapped up in that bank. And it should be, because their family name yeah. may be on the outside of the building. But you got to have succession planning. Now, nobody plans on getting hit by a bus tomorrow.
We call that a runover folder.
But you've got to be prepared for it. Yeah. You've got to have those contingency plans, and succession planning, particularly for community banks, is so important. Mm-hmm. So that they are letting folks know, okay, here's how we do some of these things. And I think for a lot of folks of, I'm 60, so I'll say of my generation, by most measures, 1963, 1964 is the last year of birth for baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And so those are the folks that are, you said, they're running a lot of these banks right mm-hmm. now, that they don't want to think about their mortality. And a lot of them want to hold on to what they know and don't necessarily want to share it.
Yeah.
Because that's what gives them the ability to stay on top. I know how to do it and nobody else does.
Yeah.
They've got to start sharing that information if they want to have the legacy of their bank going on. Now, if it's a family-owned bank, you may have other family members that are coming up. But with a lot of family businesses, banking being no different, it's unusual for it to go past that third generation.
I agree. And sometimes it doesn't make it past the second.
Right.
Because they don't have the same passion to build it as the parents did.
Right. Yeah. You know, just because dad or granddad was in banking doesn't mean that you're particularly interested in banking. Mm-hmm.
I wanted my daughter to go into banking. She tried it for a little while, but she didn't love it like I do. And I'm just like, she could be so good at it though. She really could. And it breaks my heart, but that's second generation. They just have a different path.
Well, and in this case, my daughter went into banking. And okay. So she works for a big financial institution in the San Antonio area, mm-hmm. and she's rocking and rolling, and I couldn't be more proud of her.
That's good.
But that also then comes to the importance, and I don't mean this to sound self-serving, but that's why community banks need to send some of their folks to Swigsby,
yeah.
or they could potentially send them to those other
banking schools. Lower level.
They want to send them to Swigsby. Because again, the idea is they're identifying these folks as the future leaders of their bank.
Right.
And you can't just learn to run a bank overnight. You've got to have those basic building blocks. And then you actually have to have a little bit of the experience of really doing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the difference between watching how to make a souffle and then actually doing it.
Yes.
If all you've done is watched YouTube videos on how to do it, it doesn't mean you know how to make a souffle.
That's right.
Or that you're not going to make some mistakes when you make that first one.
And I'm glad you brought that point up, because, and I know we both love Swigsby for the real world experience, but it's not just the analytics piece that you learn. You have to learn the people skills too.
Oh yeah.
A bank is full of people, and you don't want to be a toxic leader. And I mean, I know we're kind of shifting off the consolidation piece, but when you think about merging banks together, small community banks or whatever, and let's say they're family owned, you're going to have some conflict. And so it's really good to kind of work those things out ahead of time and really look at that M&A piece and say, okay, who's going to step up and be the leader in the bank, and where do I need to transition? But you need to also be able to communicate together and say, look, you know, maybe I'm better at the analytical piece and maybe you're better at the people skills piece. And so that's the role we play until we transition out. Succession planning, and we'll go back to Swigsby. You've got director training. You've got, I'm sure you've got succession training for banks and ownerships and things like that. Swigsby's not just banking school. Correct. You do training year round, and talk a little bit about that, because I think it's important if there's a bank owner or leadership out here watching this podcast, I want them to be able to know that Swigsby is much more than just sending your bankers to banking school. There's director training. There's all kinds of things you can do year round. So I'll let you kind of jump on that a little bit.
Sure. So kind of the crown jewel is the Southwestern Graduate School of Banking, the quote unquote bank school, for those 2 weeks on campus every year for those 3 years. But we have, as you'd mentioned, other training for bankers. So we have the commercial lending school. Mm-hmm. In fact, the last week of April, I'll be, you know, there on campus all week working with those folks. We work with the Independent Bankers Association of Texas on the Bank Operations Institute. So for those operations folks, the same type of thing. We also have the Certified Community Bank Directors Program. And there we have a couple of related items. One is particularly for brand new bank directors, directors of community banks, a three-day program on campus there in on the SMU campus in Dallas, where, again, we kind of give them banking 101 for bank directors. Because a lot of the directors are successful business people in their own right. But one thing that they quickly find out that running your local business is much different than running your local bank.
That's a fact.
Even if you just look at the financial statements, you know, look at the balance sheet for a bank, that if you've got a let's say typical business owner, they're going to go, how come all these loans are assets and all the deposits are liabilities? It's the opposite on mine.
That's right. That's right.
You know, how come there's no sales at the top of your income statement? Well, banks are a little bit different.
And well, so just different.
We take them through that, the basics of, as a bank director, what do they need to know? And then in association with that, we have our assemblies for bank directors. And so the Certified Community Bank Directors Program, again, the basic building blocks. The assemblies for bank directors, we do that twice a year. So we do it typically in August and February. In August, we like to go someplace cooler. So this August, we'll be in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
What?
I personally have not been to Coeur d'Alene, but everyone that I've talked to that has been says, oh gosh, you got to go. It's gorgeous. Yeah. They have the floating green on the golf course there. And so you have to take this little boat to get out to the green.
Nice.
Assuming that you can get the ball onto the green, I guess.
Not me.
And we'll have our first golf tournament there for the directors. And then in the February, we like to go someplace warm. So last year we were in Maui. This year we'll be in Palm Beach, California.
Nice.
And the idea there is that directors are getting, what are the current issues? Mm-hmm. And so we generally try to keep things in terms of, you know, what's happening in terms of best practices, what's happening in terms of on the strategic planning side, what do they need to know? We'll have industry experts there, you know, subject matter experts from literally around the globe. As we had mentioned previously, Michael Bacon, who was the whistleblower for Wells Fargo, was one of our keynote speakers. We had Mickey Bowman, one of the members on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, a actual banker, which is nice to have in that regulatory role.
Which maybe we can get Jeff Schmidt on.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she spoke first before, did a fantastic job. And so we have from your lenders to your operations folks, to your directors, and oftentimes, of course, you've got inside directors, so that includes the officers of the bank. We've got programming for them at Swigsby.
You know, just to add another little note to that, I mean, you have so much education components to Swigsby, not just for the lenders, but all these other components. But I will say that one of the things that if you've gone through an audit, you know, regulator audit, and, you know, you're getting the phone calls as a lender and all these kind of things, the preparation that you go through Swigsby allows you to be a lot more comfortable to have those conversations. And before Swigsby, I would have been terrified to talk to regulators. But after Swigsby, you have at least the confidence to go in it. Hey, I understand what I need to know and what the regulators are asking, because that's a big deal. If the regulators are calling you or the internal audit's calling you or whatever, you know, you need to have your stuff together.
Well, and similar with the board of directors, The regulators are expecting the board of directors to understand what's going on mm-hmm. with the bank. You can't, yeah. if something goes wrong and the regulators have to come in mm-hmm. saying, I didn't know about that, or I didn't understand that, is not going to be an excuse if you should have understood it.
Right.
If it shows in the board meeting minutes that you guys talked about this, then. Yeah.
And that's called a call report, folks.
yeah. You better understand what they're talking about. And
that's
so,
right.
Director education is becoming more of a focus for the regulators. And so that's part of what drives our programming.
And it used to be, and maybe I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong here, 25 years ago, 20 years ago, a director of a bank was more of a prominent position where you were looked at as, you know, it's a pillar of the community, things like that. Today, though, a director in a bank needs to totally understand what's going on in the bank, and you're expected to understand it because the regulators are much more stringent today than they were 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah,
do you think that's accurate?
I think the difference, you're right, in terms of the role of the members on a bank's board of directors is before you would brought in, because as you mentioned, maybe you're a prominent member of the community and you could help bring in bank business. Mm-hmm. Today, I think it's important for bank boards to understand that they need to have a diversified skill set. So it's important to have somebody that understands the basics of cyber. Because guess what? Your bank's going to be subject to cyber threats.
Yes.
You should have somebody that is an expert in HR. So somebody that's got a strong HR background. Because guess what? Your bank's probably going to have some HR issues, no matter mm-hmm. how great a bank it is to work for.
That's right.
You want to have folks that are, you know, just familiar with the overall financial markets. And the idea, again, is you don't want everybody that looks exactly the same. We had a speaker that I think that described most community bank boards and that they were stale, pale, and male. And so it was just a very nice way of saying old white guys.
I won't ask you who said that.
But it does describe a lot of community bank boards. Yeah. And the idea is that if everybody is in the same echo chamber, mm-hmm. then you don't have any type of diversity of thought in terms of, gosh, is this the right path for the bank to be taking? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if there's no discussion of, gosh, could this be a problem? Then you may have problems further down the road.
You know, that is a really good point to make, especially when you're thinking about consolidation or you're thinking about an acquisition. You also have to identify what does their board look like and do we need them or do we replace them?
Well, and I think that even goes more fundamental. It goes really to the culture of the bank. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at what they'll often call a merging of equals. Mm.
Yeah, that never happens.
There is no merging of equals because it's not going to be both banks' names on the door after the merger. Mm-hmm. It's going to be generally one of their names on there.
That's right.
To your point, it's generally going to be one of the sets of board of directors that takes over. And it's going to be one of the two cultures. Because no matter how much you say, oh, the cultures are very similar. They may be similar, but they're not the same. Mm-hmm. And it's only going to be one of those cultures that actually dominates. And
back to one of our previous comments about Norwest making the acquisition of Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo name stayed on the door, but it was Norwest culture that was engulfed upon top of Wells Fargo.
Exactly.
And I knew that story. A lot of people in the banking world probably did not. They realized that Norwest, you know, purchased Wells Fargo. They kept it for the branding purposes. Yeah. But the culture definitely was. And even the senior leadership was Norwest that stuck around and ran the show up until I think I came on the scene in the mid-2000s, early to before the crash, and it was still Norwest guys there, you know. So, yeah, you're right. Somebody loses and somebody wins in a merger, no matter what the situation is. Yeah.
And so you have, some banks that are well-known for their culture. Mm-hmm. Here in Texas, we've got First Financial out of Abilene and Scott Dieser, and they're non-negotiables.
Yeah.
These are the points that every employee in this bank is going to subscribe to. And if you talk to any of those bankers, every day there's a banker that's selected to talk about those points. That's mm-hmm. how strong the culture is for those.
By the way, just to mention, there are two senior guys in that bank that are from our Swigsby class. I'm just saying.
We've got First Financial has been a wonderful supporter of Swigsby over the years. And Scott Dieser is now on. He just came on the Swigsby Board of Trustees.
Okay, nice. So
we're very happy to have him on there.
Nice.
But if you look at what Pat Hickman had done with Happy Bank, exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. Non-negotiables. Now, they weren't exactly the same. It was the same term. These are our non-negotiables.
Right.
But it's laying down the law. Here's the culture of our bank. This is how we're going to behave. This is how we do things. And so there's two bankers that I respect tremendously. And a lot of it's because they laid out there, here are our beliefs. Mm-hmm. And they walked the walk and talked the talk. They were the whole package when it came to that.
I didn't realize that those two banks had fundamentally set that in place, that these are our non-negotiables.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Wow. I'd like to look at those just to get my eyes on them, because any type of leadership that is successful and succeeding or excelling, you know, I want to learn from. I think we never stop learning. So I'd love to get my eyes on those. I may have to dig into that a little bit. I know Marshall and Kyle and those guys over at First Financial, so I may have to reach out to them.
Well, and First Financial, I want to say that they even publish those. I'm 99% sure you could find it on their website.
Okay.
And I know from experience that First Financial bankers carry the non-negotiables printed in their pocket, because it was very recently I was visiting with some folks from First Financial and they handed me that, because that happened to come up in conversation.
Okay. Nice.
For Happy State Bank, there's a great biography of Pat Hickman and the beginning of Happy State Bank. Mm-hmm. I believe it's even called Non-Negotiables is the title, or at least that's part of the subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
Highly recommended. It's very good. And at least for me, I already knew Pat Hickman, but after reading that book, had even more respect for him after that.
That's great. That's great. So we talked a little bit about community banks. I want to shift just a little bit to some interesting conversations from Janet Yellen. I want to go back to Jerome Powell too. I mean, we're talking banking right here. Let's go back to the transitory word used a while back. I just want to get your thoughts on it, and then we'll kind of bring into some of her recent comments that she made last week. And I've got some conflict with her, and I want to talk about that. Okay. But tell me what you think on transitory.
Well, in fairness, hindsight's 2020. It's easy for us to now say it's obvious that inflation was not transitory. We're transitory, meaning it's just very temporary. We're not going to see this high inflation for a long period of time. You know, we peaked out at about 9%, a little over 9% inflation. Again, for anybody under 50 that's listening to this, you probably don't appreciate what inflation was like in the late 70s and early 80s, where we had
the gas lines. Do you remember the gas lines?
Well, we had the gas lines. We had double digit inflation.
Yes.
And so I'm sure we'll kind of come back to that. But part of the idea of, gosh, interest rates today are so high. No, they're not.
Not really.
These are much closer to what the long-term averages have been for interest rates. But if you've been in this industry for a dozen years or less, outside of the recent acceleration in the Fed funds target by the Fed, all you've known is almost 0% interest rates your entire banking career. Yeah,
that's right.
And although that's all you've seen, that's not all of history.
Right.
And so again, folks like, at least I'll say me that have gray hair, or some folks that have no hair. Again, we remember that you had double digit mortgage rates back in the 80s.
Now, I didn't own a home in the 80s, but when you get into the 90s, when I bought my first home, my interest rate was, I think I paid around 9.5%. And of course, I was in college. I mean, broke. Okay. But I was in college and bought my first house and, you know, all those kind of good things. But you're right. The rate is not super high right now. You go back to the late 70s, early 80s, and you're talking 13 up to 18% for a mortgage house. But go back to those houses back then. I remember my parents bought our house in 1974, and I think they paid 20-something thousand. My first house in... Bought my first house in 90, maybe $19,000. It's just a different world.
Well, it is. And so my wife and I were married in 1987.
Okay.
We bought our first home and our mortgage is at 8.5%.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that that's fantastic because the builder had bought it down 2% because market rates in 1987 were 10.5% for a 30-year fixed rate mortgage.
Wow.
Now, it was a starter home, three bedroom, one bath, one car garage, 975 square feet or so.
Not a normal house today.
Not a normal house today. And so my daughter, you know, a few years ago bought her starter home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since then she's refinanced. So she's got, I don't know, probably a 3.5% mortgage on her refinanced house, 1,750 square feet, two car garage, still three bedroom, but two bath.
Yeah.
Nearly twice as large as what my wife and I could afford. But part of that's because interest rates were half of what we had to pay.
Yeah. And interest is the largest component to a mortgage payment.
Oh, particularly if you're looking at your 30-year mortgage, absolutely. Yeah. For the vast majority of folks that if you're putting that 20% down, you're financing 80% of the home value, you're right. The biggest single proportion of that payment every month is the interest amount. So what does that say going forward for housing in the U.S.? Well, right now, part of the problem is that there is almost no existing housing on the market. Why? Because why would I sell my house with a 3% mortgage if the new house that I buy is going to have a 7% mortgage?
Yeah.
So you don't have a whole lot of existing housing. So what's on the market? Just new housing. Well, given the change in rates from just 2 years ago, if we're looking at ballpark $350,000 mortgage, the principal and interest has gone up, and it's really just the interest part
just
of that,
the interest,
has gone up by approximately $1,000. So either folks have to come up with an extra $1,000 every month, and most new home buyers don't have an extra $1,000 a month just sitting around that
they
can spend
to get
on
in
interest.
The house.
Exactly. So you got to go the other direction. At 350,000 2 years ago at a ballpark 3.25%, the P&I, principal and interest on the loan, would be about $1,500. Again, today it'd be about $2,500. So what if we go the other direction? How much can I afford if all I can afford is $1,500 a month?
Yeah.
It goes down to from 350 to about 250,000. So what are new builders going to have to do if they want to attract those folks? Because they're not, again, magically getting $1,000 more a month.
No.
They're going to have to shrink those home sizes. And they're probably going to go back closer to what the home sizes were back in the mid-80s than what they were in, you know,
And you go back to the pandemic time when the shortage of everything was there, which, you know, I won't walk down that little rabbit trail of conspiracy theory on that piece, but the reality is that the prices of everything went up because supposedly we didn't have enough lumber, we didn't have enough sheetrock, we didn't have enough X, Y, Z, whatever the case may be. People are working from home, so they want to upgrade, blah, 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 blah. But I don't see the prices coming down, you know? I don't see the price per square foot of homes coming down drastically right now. When the inventory, a lot of people aren't buying homes. So there's my son's a home builder. So, I mean, I'm kind of in tune to that. And they're not falling off. And you would think that, okay, inventory supplies are up. Lumber prices should be coming down. But, you know, you're still getting 150, 175 a foot on a brand new build, where it used to be, what, 7-8 years ago, might have been 100. You know, so I'm not certain about it. There's some hidden cost in there that I'm not really been able to track back to.
Well, part of it is if we go back to inflation. So how do we measure inflation? We basically look at a basket of goods and how much does it cost last year for that basket? How much does it cost today? And then what's the percent change in price?
Sure.
And so again, we topped out at about 9.1% in terms of that change.
And that's the basket. But there's a bunch of individuals in there that were way more than that.
Right. So some things were higher, but other things were lower. And some things actually did go down. So we've got that basket. Today, the basket's about 3.7% higher than it was a year ago. So inflation has come down. It's come from 9% to under 4%. And part of it depends on what measure of inflation you're using. So one of the things that the Fed likes to use is what they call the PCE, personal consumption expenditures. Mm-hmm. And they exclude food and energy. And a lot of folks, well, why do we exclude food and energy? I can't exclude food and energy from my budget.
That's right.
And they use it for planning purposes because food and energy is so volatile. So yes, you and I have to pay those volatile prices. Mm-hmm. And when gas prices are down at $2.69 a gallon, rather, we're happy. Mm-hmm. And today when they're at $3.09 a gallon, we're not nearly as happy. Right. You know, when it's at $2.69, I've got an extra $20 a week that I can spend on something else. When it's at $3.09, well, I guess I'm not getting that Wendy's Baconator anymore because that costing me almost $20 anymore.
That's right. Like. Depending on what time you buy it.
Exactly. If I want to get it at lunchtime, I might pay more than that.
That's right.
So are prices falling? No, not overall. But is the rate of increase less than what it was? Mm-hmm. Yes. And the biggest component in that basket are housing costs. Mm-hmm. What we're starting to see is rents in even in some of our Texas cities like Austin starting to come down.
Oh, that's great because Austin's been extremely high.
Exactly. And so you have to kind of level out and then hopefully you'll come down a little bit. And so we're starting to see some of those starting to come down. Again, I believe as builders, if you can't sell the $350,000 house, you're going to start building the $250,000 houses. As more of those start getting sold, that housing cost is going to come down. Mm-hmm. And that's over a third of the inflation component. Yeah. So I think we're going to start seeing some of that long term. To your original question, is this transitory? No. What's the right long-term rate? Well, the Fed generally previously had a kind of a target somewhere between 0 and 4. 2 was the average.
Yeah.
But as long as we were between 0 and 4, we were within our range. Now they've gotten a lot more explicit where we want to be at 2. Well, part of the problem is if we've run above 2% for a while now.
Yeah, several years.
For it to average 2, we're going to have to run below 2% for a while if we truly want 2% as our average.
Which would be a contraction.
Correct.
And that'll happen. But
well, part of what causes inflation is, you know, that idea of too many dollars chasing too few goods. It's kind of that classic definition. Mm-hmm. So what do we have the Fed doing? Well, if there's too many dollars, they're trying to take some of those dollars out. And that's exactly what they're doing.
And they are doing that, yeah.
Through the, I guess we can call it quantitative tightening, but basically not going out into the long end of the market, buying new mortgage-backed securities, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So they're letting their portfolio just kind of run off.
Yep. And they started that when? It was last year sometime they started just not rebuying, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And so they've been allowing some of this to go on for a while. They weren't growing it for a while, and then they actually started to allow it to shrink, and that's what we're starting to see. Mm-hmm. In addition, the idea of raising short-term interest rates, or at least that target for the Fed funds rate, is to make funds more expensive so people aren't borrowing as much, and therefore they're not spending as much, and that helps slow the economy down. In the past, that's worked relatively well, although it's not an exact science, and it's tough for the Fed to figure out, okay, when exactly do we change direction, or in this case, where we are today, when do we actually start to cut rates? And it's because when they increase rates or when they decrease rates, the impact of those is variable. In other words, if they cut rates, let's just say 25 basis points, what's going to be the impact of that? Well, we don't know exactly, and we don't know exactly how long it will take for it to materialize. It's not like it's going to happen overnight.
I've heard as far out as 10 quarters.
It could
for
be.
For it to truly be baked in.
So the analogy that I use for the challenge that the Fed faces is, well, let me ask first. Are you a good driver, Skip?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So you're a good driver, but all of a sudden, whatever you do in your vehicle is delayed by 10 seconds. So you need to brake. If you hit the brakes right now, 10
seconds early,
it's not going to happen for 10 more seconds. Mm-hmm. If you want to turn right, if you turn the wheel right now, you're not actually going to turn for 10 seconds. Mm. Think how much harder driving would be under those conditions. Now, what if I told you the change is going to be somewhere, the delay is going to be somewhere between 5 and 15 seconds?
Well, that's even harder.
That's what the Fed has to do when it's variable like that. We don't know how long it's going to take for the change to take effect, and we don't know how big of an impact it's going to be. Mm-hmm. We've got some guidelines. We've got some experience. But in the past, we haven't done a perfect job because oftentimes when they've been doing this, we've actually gone into a recession, which we want to avoid. Everybody talks about the soft landing. And actually, if you talk to some of the folks that are on the Federal Open Market Committee, they'll roll their eyes when we talk about soft landing. They don't want to hear it because they're so worried we're going to jinx it.
Yeah.
But they may actually be able to accomplish that because we haven't seen the increase in unemployment. Mm-hmm. We still have relatively strong job growth. Now, where is the economy going for the rest of 2024? Nobody knows. If anybody tells you they know, they're lying. Now, we have estimates. We've got forecasts. It's what I prefer to refer to as SWAG, which is a scientific wild-ass guess.
That's a Swigsby term. It's trademark. Just can't use it.
So we have models that say where we should be, but the models haven't been great because the models say that unemployment should be much higher right now. Mm-hmm. Now, even with that, our best guess, our best estimate of where GDP is going to be for the first quarter is about 2.1%. Mm. The Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank does a great job. They've got a thing called GDP Now that you can look up. And as new economic data comes in throughout the quarter, they update their estimate of where GDP is going to be at the end of the quarter. So right now, ballpark 2.1%. That's anemic growth. It's not great. It's not awful, but it's not great. Awful would be if we were negative growth. That'd be really bad. That's a recession.
Yeah.
If it's 2%, then we're not really even able to absorb new people into the economy. So at SMU, right, we'll be graduating a whole bunch of students this semester. The economy's got to grow closer to about 3% to be able to absorb all those new workers into the economy. And so we want that GDP growth to, let's say, be 3%. So we're forecasting it 2. Now, we don't want it at 4 or 5 because then that becomes very inflationary. Yeah. So 3 is kind of our sweet spot there. The economy looks like it might be coming in a little bit slower than that. And if that does materialize, then we're likely not going to see the strong job growth that we have been seeing, where we've been creating anywhere from 250 to 400,000 jobs a month, you know, over the last 12 months.
Right.
We might only be creating 100,000 as compared to 200 or 250 or 400,000. Mm-hmm. So job growth is going to be slower. The economy is going to be slower. Unemployment may start to tick up. So we may end up seeing that. Mm-hmm. Or we might have this perfect landing. Yeah. Maybe we're going to continue in this Goldilocks state where inflation does come down a little bit more and we don't see that spike in unemployment and the economy doesn't go into recession. Now, again, I'm not going to say that the Fed's done this perfect job because they kept interest rates way too low for way too long. That's part of what got us into the predicament that we're in and part of what led to the super high inflation that we did see. But at least overall, the economy seems to be in a decent place. I'm not going to say it's great, but it's I don't see us falling off a cliff real quick either.
You know, there's two things that really have shocked me lately. Obviously, we broke 40,000. Okay. I know it settled back down, but breaking 40,000 is unbelievable. And then the gold hitting a record high too. I'm not an expert in stock. I've already said that. Hey, don't follow me on any stock tips, I can assure you. But it seems to me the market's awful hot for the rate of return because stock price is driven by earnings. And it doesn't seem to me that they're lighting the world up with earnings, and yet the market is just growing like crazy. Who would have thought we'd have broke 40,000?
Right? Well, the modification I would make to your statement is the market's driven by expected earnings.
Mm, yeah, okay.
It's not really the earnings today, but it's what we think those companies are going to do. So, for example, why is NVIDIA going through the roof?
Chips.
But it's not,
AI.
Exactly, but it's yeah. not how much the chips are literally generating today in revenue for the buyers of those chips, but what we anticipate it's going to be able to do, right? So what do we think AI is going to be able to do in the future? Oh gosh, I mean, our imaginations could run wild.
Yeah. Which is our next segment. We're going to talk about AI, yeah.
So only two things drive economic growth. You either have to have more workers or you have to have increases in productivity. Mm-hmm. And I would contend that a lot of folks believe AI is going to be that next huge leap in productivity.
I would agree with that. And we're going to talk about that in our next segment about AI. And because I believe that there's some great opportunities in the banking world for AI. I also want to talk a little bit about crypto, and I want to talk about this central bank digital currency piece. So, man, I appreciate you covering these topics. Consolidation is big. Of course, we think, you know, transitory is fake. It's going to be around a while. I'm not putting words in your mouth. Yeah. I'm just, you know, from my perspective, I'm not opposed to kind of where they are on the Fed funds rate and all those kind of things. I think you're right. I think we 50 plus, which I am in that group, we remember the lines. We remember the interest rates. We remember the inflation in the 70s and 80s. A lot of things happen, but you're right. There's a generation of bankers right now that have never seen rates like this.
So current 30-year mortgage rates, again, round it, ballpark 7%. Mm-hmm. What do you think the average 30-year mortgage rate has been over the last 50 years?
Oh, it's higher than that. I saw it the other day, and it was
about 7.7%.
Yeah, it's higher than that. And so it's, in theory, you're right. We're just, this generation is not accustomed to it. I told you my first house was, I think it was 9.5%. And my parents was more than that. It was like 13 on theirs. And it was a different philosophy back then. I remember too, my parents bought this house. They paid every payment. They didn't pay it off early. And the payment was $300-something a month. Now think about that. People like today would be like, oh, I would love to have that. Yeah. I would love to have that too, but you're right. It's different houses, different prices, different rates, but you're right. The average rate is over 7%.
Well, and I'll tell you the two things that made me really start to feel old. One was when we did see interest rates, mortgage rates that my grandparents talked about.
Mm, okay.
So when we were down in that 4%, 3% range, those were the rates that my grandparents talked about when they bought their house back in the late 40s.
Okay.
You know, they had like a 4.5% mortgage rate. The second thing that made me feel real old is I remember my grandparents buying a car and they couldn't believe that the car cost more than their first house.
Yes. Yes.
My wife and I recently bought a vehicle and it cost more than the $45,000 it cost for our very first house.
My first house was 19. I passed that one a long time ago.
I'm definitely officially in that old category now.
The other thing is CD rates. Let's not forget about CD rates. Remember, 25 years ago, man, you could really park some money in CDs and it was paying good rates. Well, today we're back to the 5+ CD rates. And so I think it offsets. So you may have a 7.5% mortgage, but you got a 5+% CD rate too.
Well, and you're right. All of that has to go together. But if you're looking at that first time home buyer, that CD rate's imaginary for them because they don't have any money to put a CD.
Right. That's right. But their grandparents do.
Yes. So you're right. For the banks, actually these higher rates are a little bit better in that they've got a little bit more room for their net interest margin. They've got a little bit more control over it. You've got a lot less, what we call that compression. Mm-hmm. Because when your paying on deposits is zero,
yes,
you really couldn't go any lower than that.
No.
And your loan rates, were pretty darn low, that net interest margin got compressed pretty good.
What about when they charge for deposits?
Well, that effectively becomes a negative interest rate.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You know, because if you start with $1,000 in your account at the beginning of the month and they charge you anything and you have less than $1,000 at the end of the month, that's a negative interest rate.
That's
and
right.
So we did experience negative interest rates for a while.
That's right. Man, I appreciate it so much, Dr. Chit. Looking forward to the artificial intelligence talk.
Yeah.
Looking forward to the crypto talk. So I think those are some things that we see on the horizon. I personally don't know a lot about AI, and I certainly don't know a lot about crypto. I do have my opinions on crypto, which we'll talk about, but look forward to the next one. So if you're watching this, please follow us on YouTube, all the other channels, but Americana TV, Americana TV, it's actually Americanic.com. Go check us out. We appreciate you watching. Thanks so much, Dr. Chip.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.